Hey, what is going on? It is Crypto Bobby. Hope you are having a great day, great night, wherever you are watching or listening in from. Today, I have an awesome interview for you. It is with Scott Army and Dan Ziller from Vision Hill Advisors, which is a crypto fund of funds. I actually had a chance to meet Dan in person about a month or so ago and got a chance to talk to him just about the industry as a whole and kind of his thoughts on everything. And I thought having him and Scott on the channel to talk about what a fund of funds is, kind of what's going on with all these crypto hedge funds, and where they think the space is going from a regulatory standpoint, and a lot of other really interesting points. So I think you are going to enjoy this interview. Before we get into today's interview, I want to talk to you about my friends over at Finn. I used to wake up in the morning, look at my calendar, and think, there's no way I'm actually getting all this stuff done. And pretty much, I wouldn't actually get all this stuff done. I'd procrastinate like I usually do, watch the Jets game, do something else. Knew I needed help. That's actually when I turned and started using Finn. And I've been using Finn for a ton of things, namely managing my calendar and my email inbox. I get so many emails from Crypto Bobby. It is ridiculous. And I needed somebody to actually take the time to go through those emails and sort through what wasn't ICO spam and things that I didn't need. And Finn has saved me a ton of time when doing that, even scheduling travel and things like that for business trips, for conference speaking, for things like that. Saved me so much time. And that's why I've arranged for all of you guys to try Finn for free as well. Just use my link, finn.com/Bobby. That is finn.com/BOBBY to try Finn for free. finn.com/BOBBY. Let's get into the interview with Dan and Scott. Let's go. But really appreciate you guys taking the time to join me today. Thank you so much for that. Scott, why don't we start with you? Can you talk a little bit about your background and what led you to the creation of Vision Hill?
Yeah, of course. First, I just have to start off by saying that everything we do say here today is, of course, our own opinions and not investment advice, and should not be taken in any way as general solicitation. So with that out of the way, I'm happy to thank you, Rob,
always,
for having us, and happy to talk about my background. So my background is largely in traditional markets. I spent 11 years at JP Morgan in the investment bank, mostly on the trading side in credit. I was a corporate bond trader and credit derivatives trader for JP Morgan from 2005 to 2016. So I saw a large amount of the business cycle, and saw, you know, traded, you know, leading up to the financial crisis from 2005, 2007 through the financial crisis, and also on the back end of the financial crisis. So saw quite volatile times in the market. And I think that gives me pretty good perspective here coming into a new asset class. My crypto journey started in 2014 when I heard a talk from Barry Silbert here at the Core Club in New York City. And at the time, Barry was transitioning second market. He was selling it to NASDAQ, and he had just started Digital Currency Group, which obviously has grown into one of the largest players in our space now. And that talk was really what kind of dropped me down the rabbit hole in crypto. You know, and at the time, I couldn't get comfortable with custody, and so I didn't end up investing. And as we used to say on the trading floor, hindsight capital is always up a lot of money, and if it's not, you're sort of in trouble. You know, I wish I had invested at that point, but I dropped down the rabbit hole and I followed the industry ever since. The second light bulb moment that really pushed me in was in 2016, when I had started a mobile app and web development business. And as a result of that, I was much deeper in the developer community. And the developer community at the time in late 16, early 17 was very much a buzz about Ethereum. And so that was the second thing that really pushed me into this market. I started personally investing in the space. I started with Ethereum and then Bitcoin, and then that moved into sort of, you know, early ICOs, some SAP projects and things like that. And the whole time this was occurring, I was basically talking crypto to anyone that would really listen, right? And a lot of people were encouraging me to open my own fund given the risk and portfolio management background that I had. And so I stepped back and I took a lot of time to think about that and think about what they were really asking. And I determined what they were really asking was they wanted a way to allocate to this new space, to this new technology, and they wanted to do it with someone that they could trust. And so that's how Vision Hill was really born organically, as a bridge of capital into this new space.
Awesome. And Dan, if you wouldn't mind, you know, going into your background a little bit, how you got to, you know, kind of meet Scott and join Vision Hill as well, that'd be awesome.
Sure. Again, Bob, thanks for having us here. I'm really excited to be here. My background is also in traditional finance. I used to work in the complex asset solution service line at Duff & Phelps, where we focused a lot on structured product valuation and transaction advisory. So we weren't just valuing general equity and general debt. No, we were valuing slightly more complicated assets, such as loan pools and contingent value rights and even asset-backed securities. So that background really strengthened my analytical capabilities. I completed the CFA program in 2016 that unlocked a lot of portfolio management insights for me. And as a result, I wanted to use that and apply it in practice. So in late 2016, I ended up joining Citigroup on behalf of their pension fund as an institutional investor. There I essentially co-managed a $1 billion sub-portfolio of various allocations to multi-billion dollar fund managers that were pursuing various strategies in the private equity, the venture capital, and the hedge fund markets. So that taught me a lot about investment due diligence, evaluating managers, pursuing various strategies, and trying to find the best managers that are equipped to capture outsized returns in various markets. So my crypto journey basically started shortly after while I was at Citigroup. Similar to Scott, I've always been fascinated by technology, and I think in the case of crypto, I just became obsessed with the possibilities that these technologies impose on the world. So naturally, I started to essentially learn about the space, and I really wasn't sure the best way to navigate my career to the space full time. So in early 2018, I ended up being accepted into the volunteer program at Messari when they were first getting off the ground. For those not familiar with Messari, it's basically a open source data library that is trying to promote transparency and smarter decision making in the crypto asset ecosystem. So as one of the early volunteers, I was able to essentially contribute to a lot of valuation frameworks and how to think about the potential this asset class imposes. I had the ability to work with a few fund managers in the space to derive valuation techniques. And naturally, I found my way to Scott, who at the time was starting to put together the framework for Vision Hill. So my background and Scott's background, we believed it sort of to be complementary and natural fit. So that's basically how we got to where we are today.
Awesome. Appreciate the intro from both you, Scott and Dan. And also cool to hear too. I mean, I know a couple of people that have participated in the Messari volunteer program that they have. And then that's from I think you had mentioned it, but Ryan Selkis, aka 2-Bit Idiot on Twitter, who I'm sure a lot of people listening to this now follow as well. But kind of cool to see how, you know, so many people have gotten into this space, kind of diving down a rabbit hole initially, doing a bunch of research on their own, maybe even volunteering while kind of working full time or doing something complimentary. So interesting to hear that kind of genesis story there, and just a little bit about your backgrounds. And you know, I think one thing that a lot of people are familiar with in the space is these crypto funds or these, you know, crypto hedge funds, whatever they, you know, whatever you want to call them. But Vision Hill is working on, you know, what's called a fund of funds. So can you explain to anybody who's not familiar what a fund of funds actually is and how you see yourselves in this ecosystem?
Yeah, of course. Listen, we're not trying to reinvent the wheel. The fund to fund model is, you know, a very proven business model that's worked in other traditional asset classes. And, you know, it is exactly how it sounds. It's a hedge fund of hedge funds that invests in hedge funds. So, in that regard, you know, the fund to fund business really started in the 60s and didn't really gain traction until the early 90s. In the early 90s, that's when hedge funds really kind of started gaining significant traction. And the fund-to-fund model was evolved because it provided a way to access these new strategies. They were very difficult to understand and difficult to access, so that was one of the things that, that was important. The other thing that was, made the fund-to-fund model important was that it was a team of people that could look at these new hedge fund strategies and understand them, diligence them, and communicate what they were actually doing. So the fund-to-fund model was basically providing access and then providing the diligence and sophistication to be able to look at that. And that's essentially what we're doing, and we're just applying it to a new asset class that is effectively crypto.
Sure. Now that makes a ton of sense. And I think there are a lot of people too that are familiar with, some of the big names in the space. I think, I don't know if it was Fortune or Forbes, where they just are actually, I think it was Wall Street Journal yesterday that had a big kind of profile on Olaf from Polychain Capital, and then Pantera. There's, all these different, crypto funds that are larger in scope. And then there's also every other person you meet at a conference or at a meetup group is, hey, I am running a crypto fund.
Sure.
With the diligence that your team, Dan and Scott, that you guys have done, how many crypto funds exactly are there right now that people can actually even invest in if they wanted to?
Sure. That's actually a good question. We have a database in-house that, as of today, is approximately 325 funds and growing by the day. Part of how we create that list, like I said, Bob, is a lot of attending conferences, meeting new people that are trying to fundraise in the space. Part of it is also just us doing our own in-house research that enables us to see who the major players are in the space. It's not just the headline funds. It's also a lot of other players that might be much smaller, but very active in the community. And also simply reading the news. The sometimes news tends to shine insight onto funds that we've never heard of. And then that's kind of how we built out our list organically.
Yeah, we also see, as a result of having a lot of conversations with people in the space, and the more fund managers we diligence, the more we uncover, right? Because just like anything else, a warm introduction to someone goes a long way. So the more fund managers we talk to, they end up doing introductions to other fund managers that they respect in the space. And so therefore, our network continues to grow the more people we talk to.
Totally. And then, when you look at, when you look at the number of funds that are in the space, whether you're just kind of maybe an individual or an institutional investor, how do you kind of even begin when you start evaluating that number of funds? If you're somebody who's looking to participate in like the investment ecosystem there, how do you break down like what's actually in a fund that is worthy of investment? Or maybe what's one, somebody that just doesn't have a level of qualification that you would feel comfortable, allocating any type of capital to, or, you wouldn't suggest anybody to allocate, capital to. How do you go through that process of actually beginning the diligence there?
Sure. This is something we thought, a lot about over many, many months, of that process of diligence. And so, what we've come to and how we think about it is we segment really in three ways. We segment first by market, then we segment by fund strategy, and then segment by theme. So let me touch on the first one first. So segment by market. How do we speak to market? We look at the crypto markets as public crypto markets, private crypto markets, and then what we call crypto-enabled markets. So the public crypto markets are what most people are probably familiar with, right? You go to CoinMarketCap or OnChainFX, and you can see the liquid listed trading tokens out there in the market. Right now the overall network value is give or take 180 billion. That topped out around 800 billion, give or take, in late December, early January. And so that's what everyone is. You're normally familiar in the public crypto markets. The private crypto markets are more akin to venture capital, right? It's projects and protocols that are raising private capital, the same way a private company would raise a Series A, Series B, Series C round in venture. Examples of that would be something like Blockstack or Filecoin or Definity, right? And then the third way we think about the market is what we call crypto-enabled. And then crypto-enabled is really, it can happen in two ways. It can happen where there's new business models that have been enabled by this asset class, or there can be existing business models that are now applied to this new asset class. So something new would be like a mining strategy or staking strategy. Something existing would be a credit strategy a traditional lending, credit strategy that just has a new form of collateral, and that new form of collateral is crypto, right?
Yeah, I think those are great points. And the subject of like market segmentation is pretty interesting, breaking that down into like publicly traded, I guess you could say publicly traded crypto, kind of more of the private investments that hopefully at one point in time will actually be liquid public investments, and then the crypto related businesses. Just curious on this, like when you evaluate these funds, like what type of, is there like a specific breakdown of like what you see is most common amongst funds? Is there, are they really focusing solely on one of these kind of three components, or is it typically like a blend across for a specific fund? I'm just kind of curious like where a lot of these crypto funds fall from like a market segmentation perspective.
Well, I appreciate that leading, because that sort of points to our second market segmentation, right? It's segmenting by fund strategy. So, when you look at 325 funds and you say, okay, they're all crypto hedge funds, like what does that really mean? I think it's important to go one level deeper here and think about the actual strategies that are being employed. And so again, internally, we have three different ways of thinking about that map very closely to what I just described, public, private, and crypto-enabled markets. If we focus on the liquid part right now, you can have a fund manager that just buys the assets they like and they hold them for a certain duration, right? And that would be an example of some sort of fundamental long-only manager. You could also have someone who is a long-short manager, and shorting in this market is continuing to develop, but in that case, they would actively short things that they don't like in the market. Mm-hmm. You can also have strategies like a smart beta, where you are trying to index to a certain benchmark, but you're adding or subtracting assets in a way to attempt to outperform that index. An example of something in sort of the inefficient markets bucket that we call it would be an exchange arb strategy. So in that regard, you're just capitalizing on the price differentials between different exchanges, geographically, and you're having much less market risk in that strategy. And then sort of the third bucket is how people attack that private market, right? And there's many ways to attack the private market. You can do it via private pre-sales, pre-ICOs, SAFs, as we mentioned. But we bifurcate really between thinking about the private token area of that market and then the private equity area of that market. Mm-hmm. And the equity is really in businesses that are involved in crypto that may not have a tokenized model. And so it's really across those three strategies. And of course, there's many more that I didn't mention, but we really try to take it one level deeper than a crypto fund at a general level.
Yeah, maybe one thing to add there is the fact that a lot of these managers that pursue different strategies also express different themes. And what I mean by themes are, if you look at the monetary history and the evolution of money, you might believe that the sound money thesis is a viable theme that you want to express. But that doesn't necessarily mean you are just going to purchase and hold Bitcoin. You could be a long short manager that buys Bitcoin when you believe it to be in a bullish market cycle, and you could also choose to short Bitcoin when you believe the market cycle turns. So that is an example of combining a long short strategy with a sound money thesis. Other examples of themes that we're seeing in the space include infrastructure, whether it's financial infrastructure such as exchanges, or the picks and shovels, so to speak, that contribute to building out the ecosystem. Non-fungible tokens is another area that is pretty interesting to us. There's a lot of gamers that really value the idea of digital scarcity. Token curated registry is another example. So, kind of how Scott outlined it, we think a lot about segmentation, we think a lot about strategies, and we also think a lot about themes.
Yeah, appreciate it.
Yeah, and we, Sorry, Rob, to cut you off. Just to add to one thing, you know, we think a lot about what the right combination of those strategies are, right? Because we believe we're, again, so early in this market that we're trying to maximize the opportunity set by looking as broad as possible. And what we're trying to do also is minimize the idiosyncratic risk related to single funds. So that could be security risk, operational risk, and quite frankly, the strategy risk that's being employed, right?
Yeah, absolutely. And one kind of question I was gonna maybe bounce off that is, you know, with the different strategies and themes that are you know, that are kind of now coming out, it seemed like at least, and this is from really an outsider's perspective, but at least initially speaking, it seemed like the majority of these crypto funds were kind of fundamental long-only funds initially. And then now, at least from what I'm seeing and talking to different people in the industry, is that there's a lot more variety of strategies and themes. And there's kind of like a maturation of this like head crypto fund market, where, you know, people initially started off and just either by, you know, kind of stroke of luck or just, you know, incredible foresight, whatever, really all you had to do was be fundamental long only. And as we're seeing this year, that if you're fundamental long only, you crushed it last year and now you're down 40, 50, 60%, and, you know, people probably aren't too happy with you. Do you feel like that there is kind of like a maturation in this, you know, in this kind of crypto fund space where there is now maybe more sophistication and more variety when it comes to strategies and themes as well?
Yeah, I think that's happening every day, right? I mean, that's why we're very, very encouraged at this point in time, even though we are, you know, in a bear market, at least on the public side. We are seeing that maturation happen by the day, by the month. You know, funds, even in the way that they market themselves, are talking, you know, to these specific strategies, right? And what they're trying to employ at a fund level. So we're absolutely seeing that. Another thing we see a lot of is, you know, we talked about, you know, liquid markets and private markets. We're seeing a combination of the two. Oftentimes funds come out and they say, listen, these are the themes we're trying to express, and here's how we express them in the public markets, and here's how we also, you know, say 30%-50% of the portfolio might be employed in the private markets. And so in that way, it's a barbell strategy, looking at the top end of the market and also the, you know, maybe underdeveloped or still developing part of the private markets in crypto as well.
For sure. And you know, there's been a little bit of, even in the past like day or two, there was some SEC action, there was some kind of commentary from a variety of US regulators. So, I mean, regulation has definitely been something that's kind of always been, at least in the past like year or so, been on the forefront of the minds, I feel like, of crypto investors. Have you felt that like any recent regulation has impacted the market? And do you see any specific opportunities or challenges as a result of that?
Yeah, good question. You know, I'd say first, you know, we are big advocates of clear, concise, and thoughtful regulation pretty much in any market. I think that, you know, it provides a nice tailwind when there's a clear regulatory environment. And I think a lot of people might have hoped that the regulatory bodies would have moved quicker, in this asset class. But I think you have to remember that they are potentially setting precedent for the next 10, 15, 20, maybe even 50 years on the way that they set their frameworks, you know, for this asset class. So we think they're doing a pretty decent job in that effect. You know, one of the things that really attracted both of us into this industry, you know, in addition to sort of the technological complexities was, you know, if you look at how ICOs democratized access to capital, you know, and provided, you know, an even opportunity playing field to a lot of people at a really early stage to participate in things that could, you know, have huge benefits to society, that was something that really, really resonated with us. And I think it's part of the mission of this asset class. You know, as a result of the SEC and other bodies, you know, kind of looking more closely at the asset class and saying that, you know, maybe some of these things don't really fit in our, you know, our issuance or our security framework. What it's done is it's swung the pendulum, at least in the short term, back into the private markets, right? And so a lot of these companies, instead of doing public ICOs, are now doing private rounds. And again, that goes to what we were talking about a minute ago, but you're seeing them do private pre-sales to hedge funds, to venture funds. And that's because they are accredited investors and qualified purchasers, and they fit more nicely in the box of the securities framework. So that certainly is a great opportunity, and we try to watch these trends in the market, because that pendulum could very easily swing back in the other direction, and you have to be ready to kind of capitalize on those things.
Yeah, there was an interesting article, and I think, well, it wasn't necessarily the most breaking news, but it was, I think, a good summation of kind of how the market as a whole has moved, or ICOs in specific have moved from public facing or just public like opportunities to really exclusively to crypto funds and to accredited institutional investors. And then even to taking out, if you take out some of the larger ICOs that have happened, or token sales in the past like 6 months, EOS, Telegram, and a couple other larger ones, a lot of the activity is just kind of cooled down with the public out of it. So I think that's was a pretty interesting article. I'll try to post a link to that in the YouTube link in the podcast. But I thought that was a good summation on your end, and then also just confirmation from that TechCrunch article.
Yeah, exactly. And even one thing I'd add to that is, we really are advocates for the democratization of investing. And even if the pendulum has sort of shifted back towards the private markets, we don't necessarily view that as a bad thing. Even if accredited investors and institutional investors are trying to gain access to these projects to try to extract a return on investment, we don't necessarily believe that to be bad per se, because what we've seen in a lot of the public ICOs are a lot of young projects that essentially aren't able to manage what is a public project. They didn't have any operational partners, they didn't have any strategic advisors to help them to figure out how to scale to critical mass. So what we're seeing is a lot of the fund investors are not necessarily just cutting checks and hoping that the value gets created. They are in fact rolling up their sleeves to try to work directly with the engineers, directly with the developers, and trying to help them solve very tough problems in order to better themselves and better the projects.
Totally. And when you look at when you look at fund managers, I think it's kind of been interesting to, even just like as a preface to this, it's been interesting to me to see like the marketing done from some of these fund managers, or just like the different kind of unique specializations. Like some of these fund managers are always on TV. Some of them are, like Olaf was in Wall Street Journal and previously in Forbes and Fortune, and like having these profiles in these big mainstream magazines. Some of the fund managers put out these like research reports and all this free content to try to like promote their own personal brand and the brand of their fund. But how do you actually differentiate between like a great fund manager and someone who just might have a marginal track record or marginal future performance in the when you're looking at looking across this spectrum of 300 plus crypto funds?
Yeah, well, if you started in traditional markets, obviously you would start with track record, right? Yep. And, as one of our advisors likes to say, it takes 3 years to get a 3-year track record. So if you look at this asset class, it's still very early. And so not a lot of people have, that track record. We would say though that it's not exactly something that we see as a negative, because it's more about how you're thinking about new markets here, because they are largely sort of undeveloped at this point. And we try to select A-plus managers based on how they think about this market.
So when we think about what exactly an A-plus manager is, what does that mean? So what we have seen here are that there are essentially two breeds of managers that have started to emerge in this ecosystem. On one hand, there are a lot of fundamentals-focused managers that are trying to experiment with a lot of quantitative metrics and run those into spreadsheets to try to come up with illustrations of value creation and value capture, or even certain cases where value could be lost or destroyed. So we view that as almost one bucket of managers. And then the second bucket of managers is almost on the other side of the spectrum, where they are a little more qualitative. They do understand that value capture is important. They're just a little less concerned about that today. They're more so thinking about what could exist tomorrow that is not necessarily here today. So just at a high level, that's how we've seen this manager landscape evolve There's almost like two different breeds. So going back to the fundamental breed, you know, these managers are simply trying to use metrics, whether it be GitHub metrics like pull requests from repositories, whether it be fundamental metrics like estimating velocity and applying the equation of exchange. Now, they're trying to look at the ecosystem, looking at particular crypto assets that we refer to as productive crypto assets or that have equity-like attributes. And they're simply just trying to run discounted cash flow methodology as the same way you would run it in traditional equity markets. They're trying to essentially bootstrap that same model for the crypto asset class. And that could be really valuable because it could shine a lot of insight into how value can flow through a project. But of course, you have to be a little careful that a lot of these metrics can be gamed. There could be a lot of manipulation in certain metrics. So, almost like in the dot-com days, eyeballs was a metric, the number of eyeballs that flowed to a web page. It's trying to dictate investment decisions based on certain metrics. It's something that should be a supplement rather than a primary strategy. Switching gears to the other side of the spectrum, the more qualitative managers. Now, these managers are really enthusiastic about harnessing the power of distribution channels that are amplified by technology that enables projects to scale to critical mass. So what I mean by that is we take a simple example, like if you were to try to value Uber in the early days in 2009, you could have taken what you believe to be the San Francisco taxi market and thrown that into a spreadsheet to think about what that total addressable market looks like and determined whether or not to make the investment. I think if you made that investment, given where we are in 2018, you would probably be pretty impressed with the upside. But let's say, for example's sake, you decided that the risk-reward trade-off was not attractive, that it was too risky, and you didn't make the investment. I think you would have been disappointed because Uber unlocked a lot of potential, given that it is a peer-to-peer platform in a relatively decentralized marketplace. It has gone on to scale to global mass and unlocked markets in the freight industry, in the food delivery industry, and even today it's experimenting with self-driving cars. So, unlocking new markets is something that we focus a lot on, and I think at a higher level, that's kind of how we think about evaluating managers from an investment perspective.
On just want to add one thing. So that's the investment side, and I think it's important to also touch on the operation side because, again, like we said, not a lot of these early stage managers have a long track record. So we really dig in on the operational side of people's businesses, and what we mean by that is sort of security around their firm, custody of how they're custodying their assets, whether it's third party custody or self custody, and what those best practices are. Asset verification, whether that's on chain or via a third party fund administrator, and then business risk. How do you think about funding the business side of your business so that you can you're actually covering operating costs and keeping the lights on that allows you to actually be investing on the investing side, right? And so those we also employ sort of third party consultants on the operational side to look at fund managers as well because that's part of our process.
Gotcha. Yeah, it totally makes sense. And I think, those are all, I think even like interesting discussion points that you could even go into on its own as far as custody being, the big thing that is, or one of the big things that is supposed to be holding institutional investors back, and then the security around that, some of the business risks associated with maybe these crypto funds custodying with somebody else or doing their own self-custody. A lot of interesting things there. And I think it's pretty cool to hear how you're using the consultants to kind of dive into that, because that might be, maybe your area of expertise is more on the actual diligence and fund manager, or picking fund managers and picking these specific funds and not necessarily on cybersecurity risk and things like that. So pretty cool to hear kind of how you're handling that and how you're also including that within the due diligence as well. But looking at looking at the space as a whole, when you've been looking at the landscape and kind of evaluating it, what have been some of your biggest takeaways recently either, you know, in regards to just crypto funds or the industry as a whole? Any like lessons learned or surprises there at all?
Sure. For me, you know, when I set out to sort of build this again organically, you know, you're well aware of probably, the, as you mentioned, you know, the big headline funds in the space. You know, but quite frankly, after doing a lot of diligence, what's been surprising is that the investable universe is actually a lot smaller than we had originally thought. When we look at it, you look at the, you know, we think the total addressable market here is probably give or take about $6 billion in crypto hedge funds. And when you look at the top 20 funds, they comprise about 40% of that AUM. So there is a significant concentration at the top part of the market. Now, with that said, there's also many, many managers between what we like sort of 10 to 50 million in AUM. And there's some really, really interesting strategies. You talked before about the maturation of this industry. We're seeing a lot of unique strategies come up in that $10 to $50 million range. And some of them may be actually capacity constrained, and they need the market to kind of grow a little bit more in order for them to grow in AUM. So it's not necessarily a limitation on AUM game from an investment standpoint. It's really the uniqueness of the strategy across the thing.
I think for me, one pleasant surprise has been the fact that there is no shortage of world-class talent and passion in the space. You know, people are coming from all sorts of backgrounds, whether it's deep financial markets, Wall Street executives, or tech entrepreneurs, developers, and engineers. People are really, the open source ethos and you know, ability to help build this future, even if it's not something anyone knows exactly what that looks like today. A lot of people are collaborating together to try to figure out how to answer very difficult questions. It's a really beautiful thing.
Yeah, I couldn't agree more. I mean, I've always been impressed, and especially now kind of working full time in the industry too. Like, I've always been impressed with the level of talent in the meetings I have, and just kind of the thoughtfulness and the approach, and just the general interest that people have. Because I think, you know, maybe when you come from a more traditional background, a lot of people just there collecting a paycheck, kind of doing their own thing, but not really, you know, passionate about the industry or really interested in the conversation as a whole. And it's the total opposite in just the crypto landscape. I think there's some incredibly passionate people that are also freaking smart as hell. So I think that that's definitely a great point. And you know, as we're kind of looking at the time here, wanted just to turn it over to you guys. I mean, is there anything maybe that I haven't covered or any questions perhaps that I missed that you'd like to just discuss on either what your team is doing or anything just generally speaking?
There's one thing we've been working on a lot recently, and it comes up in every conversation we have with fund managers. We, you know, one of the things we talk a lot about is what's your benchmark? You know, how do you look at your fund and what do you benchmark to? And a lot of people use Bitcoin, which is okay in some cases. Others will use other indices out there, maybe the Whole 10, the Bletchley Index, Galaxy. There's a handful of those things that are all doing really good work in the space, but they may not be the best benchmark, you know, for a fund. You know, for example, if you just looked at performance between an exchange-yard fund and a long-only fund, you know, you're comparing apples to oranges here, right? Because one has a significant amount of market risk and the other really doesn't. It's something we're working on. We're working hopefully to release it very, very soon, but a framework of comparison in the same way we talked about those strategy buckets of how we segment, and the ability to basically compare a fund, you know, within that category to another fund in that same category on a performance basis. And so it'll be something that it'll act as a call to action to, you know, funds in the space to help us develop this framework. But we've been spending a lot of time thinking about it.
That's interesting. Yeah, I've and even just going back to that Wall Street Journal piece the other day, hearing about kind of the uniqueness of benchmarks and of where people are taking profit, how they're marking up against profit. A lot of really, I feel like, different intricacies across the board for some of these funds. So cool to hear about a framework that your team is working on and releasing. So that's awesome. But I really do appreciate the time today. It was awesome to speak with you both. And We'll definitely include links to your, links to your Twitter handles and everything like that, and kind of where to reach you guys. So appreciate the time, and thank you so much, Dan and Scott.
Thank you, Rob. Really, really great to be here. Thanks, Bob.
Awesome. Thanks, guys.